But first, we're off for our weekly Shapiroette. How are you traveling, Bruce?
Well, I am fine. The world outside my doorstep is, you know, let's be honest, it's increasingly grim. I'm here in New Haven, and we've had a growing number of deaths in this small city, 15 deaths, almost 700 cases. In the next town over, there's a little nursing home, Whispering Pines Nursing Home, in which there have been 12 coronavirus deaths. And in a single cluster, nursing homes around the U.S. are turning into charnel houses. And of course, down the road in New York, the situation is just as grim as can be. Across the street from my campus at Columbia University, there's now a refrigerator truck parked outside St. Luke's Hospital for the coronavirus dead, and we've got, you know, 21 teachers who died in New York City, and mass graves being dug on Hearts Island in the Bronx. It's an altogether horrific and unprecedented time.
I was talking to a couple of distinguished Indian journalists the other night, expressing my concern that in Modi's world, the treatment of, say, Muslims and, dare I suggest, lower castes mightn't be as generous as it is to Hindus. I mention that now because we are seeing, surely, evidence of a growing racial divide in coronavirus deaths in the U.S.
Well, it's really quite dramatic. In cities like New York and Chicago, the disproportionate representation of African Americans among those hospitalized and those dying is off the charts. And it's become already, in very short order, a point of real political contention. And look, it's clear that a virus doesn't distinguish based on race, but politics does. And distribution of resources does. You've got communities of color in American cities and American small towns that are, comparatively under-resourced in their access to medical care, are already subject to a wide range of health risks, ranging from blood pressure and heart attacks to other stress-driven illnesses that put people at greater risk. Asthma is a major issue in the African-American community, and all of these are coming together in a truly tragic way that I think is going to resonate in American politics for a long, long time. You know, as are other inequalities, the inequalities of age segregation, the inequalities at the border of immigrant communities, and the inequalities of people's ability to leave crowded cities. Who rides mass transit? Mass transit workers in New York City are dying at a much higher rate than the general population. This is a disease that has come into the most unequal economic environment and racial environment in memory, and it's therefore having profoundly unequal results.
I want to spend much of our time together talking about the fact that Bernie and Biden have stopped social distancing and come together. But before we do, were you as astonished as many of us were to hear Trump talking about his absolute power at that press conference?
It was, even coming from this president, it was an astonishing outburst, in part because, of course, it has no legal or constitutional standing, but also to me, particularly ironically, because the shape of this crisis, the depth of it in the U.S., is in large part because up until now, Trump so assiduously refused responsibility. When he was asked for leadership, he turned away throughout the early weeks of this pandemic, whether it was in intervening to ensure access to ventilators and masks, or in a coordinated national approach to shutting down the economy. The result is this patchwork of governor state-level responses. So to hear him attempt to seize the reins was all the more astonishing. And I think it's only going to feed those critics, even within the Republican Party, who are now saying, you know, just walk away from these daily press conferences, let the scientists speak. But clearly, his ego requires these daily circuses. Before we get to hear from the scientists, we have to get Trump. And now these have turned into kind of 90-minute rants. His own whatever internal compass and discipline the president had early on in these press conferences has completely vanished. And it's now this kind of unprecedented daily circus, now asserting authoritarian power after having turned away the real responsibilities of the federal government and the presidency up till now.
Any attempts to constrain him by senior Republicans?
Well, we've had Lindsey Graham, who is probably the person he listens most to in the U.S. Senate, say publicly that these are counterproductive. But, you know, the real circle of advisors to Donald Trump is a circle of one, himself, and he is going to do what he does. I think the real damage is, first of all, the kind of daily distraction from the real substantive decisions to be made about this pandemic. And it's also a national atmosphere in squabbling about authority. You know, now that we're beginning to talk about the other side of this horrific curve, and how to reopen institutions and reopen government and reopen parts of the economy, you've now got all kinds of players, not just Trump, but all kinds of players now arguing with one another. I mean, in New York, Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio have kind of distinguished themselves over this last week by pettiness in squabbling publicly over who gets to reopen the New York City schools, with Mayor de Blasio saying he'd like to open them before the end of the school year, and the governor simply not disagreeing with the substance, but going public to say it's not De Blasio doesn't get to make the call. The governor gets to make the call. There's this whole national epidemic of who's in charge here.
But the one person who is constitutionally not in charge is, of course, the president, who now claims total power.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, look, now you do have some of the governors acting in a more sensible way, looking at establishing kind of regional compacts, both on the East Coast in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, and on the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington. All those governors are now talking about coordinating their coronavirus response and their coronavirus reopening plans to minimize the chance of contagion, I mean, of the disease returning and re-escalating. On the other hand, you still have some holdout governors. The governor of South Dakota continues to resist regulation and continues to resist joining the rest of the country, even though there now are some big clusters, some real hot spots in South Dakota and rural America, which has come to the pandemic late, is beginning to be overrun in ways that are going to wipe out the economies of small towns and overwhelm the our poor rural health system.
Bruce, let's switch to Bernie and Joe and that split screen announcement.
A really unusual moment in a season of unusual moments. Bernie, of course, withdrew from the race last week, and yesterday sat down via Zoom, I guess it was Zoom, and had something we've never seen in an endorsement, which is a conversation between two national political figures in which they each went out of their way to acknowledge the strength of one another's campaigns, their respect, and I think genuine affection for one another as individuals. What you also saw in this announcement, as Bernie much more the intellectual and Biden much more the sort of gosh golly from the heart politician as they spoke, was you did see Bernie gently moving the goalposts to the left. You saw Biden, who's described as a centrist, but I think really is simply a conventional politician who will follow the center of gravity where it tends to be. You saw Bernie moving the goalposts on issues like student debt, on issues like health, and Biden clearly trying to find a way to move a bit in that direction. It will be very interesting to see what the Democratic platform happens to be. It will be very interesting to see if Bernie is able to keep his the majority of his voters, his enthusiastic supporters, strongly behind Biden. The issue has never been, will Bernie voters on the whole vote for Biden? Many of them will, but will they be enthusiastic? Will they turn out in large numbers? We got an interesting lesson last week in what happens when there's a highly motivated Democratic electorate, even in this crazy pandemic time. There was this special, this primary in Wisconsin, which had all kinds of problems because the state went ahead with it despite coronavirus fears. But there was also a very important election for state Supreme Court judge in which there was a Republican candidate personally endorsed and pushed by President Trump. And a liberal Democratic woman came from behind and surprised everybody by seizing this state Supreme Court seat in a truly lopsided election, winning by 30,000 votes in a very low turnout year. I think that reflected anger and motivation in the Democratic voters of Wisconsin. Can that translate 6 months from now to the fall, when the election may still be challenged by the pandemic, when we're into a general election season? This is the earliest in memory that a Democratic primary has ended. So even without coronavirus, we don't know what the arc of the Biden campaign is going to look like with Bernie kind of in on board this early. The total opposite of 2016, when Bernie went to the convention with only lukewarm Hillary support, and there was a lot of argument that in some ways is still going on today about whether Bernie had done enough for Clinton back in 2016.
Thanks for your time, Bruce. That was the voice of Bruce Shapiro, and that was our Shapiroette, which we have on Tuesdays on the Little Wireless program.